super strong, supernatural, and super bad. His punch can topple a skyscraper. His kick can split the earth in two. More destructive than an earthquake. Mightier than a tidal wave. A one-man disaster area.
42nd Street Pete.
Shot full of lead and he still ain't dead. Jump back, Jack, for your skull is cracked.
42nd Street Pete.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Deacon of Debauchery. 42nd Street Pete.
Oh, yeah. Wop-bop-a-loo-bop-a-lop-bam-boom. It was a lot of debauchery at the Sex, Dope, and Cheap Thrill show this Wednesday night. We did that. Vanessa Del Rio came out. Eric Danville produced it and gave us 10 minutes of his time on stage. I was the host and the interviewer, and it was completely, utterly off the fucking hook.
That's awesome.
She was insane. You know, I really hadn't seen her. God, we had done a show. Well, when I first met her, I'll give you a little history on the whole thing. I was doing the Something Weird stuff, you know, writing for them.
Right.
And done the Blue Book number one, and they had wanted, you know, to interview her and interview Annie Sprinkle, being they were out of New York and stuff, and they had a lot of Vanessa's loops. So Frank Hennenlotter was my editor at the time, proofreader and all-around great guy. And he said, you know, originally it was supposed to be Lisa Petruzzi was going to do it. And he goes, no, you got to do it because you're going to ask all the pertinent questions, like how many loads would she take in the face, this and that. I go, Frank, I'm not going to fucking get that disgusting, you know. So I had honestly never interviewed anybody in my life. This was probably back in 94, I would think. So, you know, I had... I was down at the Atlantic City video show, which was, you know, co-hosted by AVN, Adult Video News Magazine. And she was there, and she hairline went around the block, and so did Ron Jeremy's. What a weird parallel, because I still don't fucking get it. But anyway, I walked up, introduced myself. So, you know, I'm working for Something Weird. They had contacted you, and, you know, can we do this? And she goes, yeah, she gave me her home phone number, call her up, whatever. So people started saying, well, you know, sometimes she can get really bad, you know, on the phone and shit and really nasty and stuff. So I said, you know, Frank, what do I do? And he goes, well, just get the tape rolling. So, you know, like I say, I research my stuff and I, you know, try to get as much background information as I could. And I have a lot more now, by the way. But I called her up. I had an answering machine as my tape recorder, and I had 3 30-minute blanks, and I filled all three of them. And it was like, no matter what I came up with, it triggered off another memory. And the interesting part of the whole thing is that if you buy her book, if you can pick up a copy of the Something Weird Blue Book, because it's way out of print and probably worth $3,000 on eBay, opening bid, my interview is almost a condensed version of her book, so to speak. So it's pretty interesting how, you know, things come about. So what happened was I was talking to Eric Danville, you know, who used to work for Screw and wrote the book To Complete Linda Lovelace, and he's going to be on the show soon. And we were talking about doing something, and he came up with the whole Sex, Dope, and Cheap Thrills show, like a multi, you know, some, you know, like a cult underground type New York thing, you know, trying to get New York personalities out. And I suggested Vanessa. And he says, well, you're still in touch with her. And I said, well, no, not really, because, you know, I run into her like, okay, you know, we had done, you know, the interview, then we had done the AVN show, and then we'd done this really weird show down in South Jersey where they decided that you can't have adult-oriented material in a nightclub with liquor. They decide this on the fucking day of the show. So we wound up outside in a tent. I was with Liquidators. We had a ton of videos and DVDs and stuff. She was signing her stuff in the tent. We had the Black Star Minaj coming down with us and things. So that was pretty much the last time I saw her in the flesh. So, you know, Eric had asked me, he goes, you know, he can get a hold of her. And I says, I don't know if she would remember me. It's, you know, been a good many years, but she did. And we set this up, and, you know, nobody knew what to expect from this whole thing. She called me the day of the show, and she goes, well, how do you want to work this? You're doing the interview, right? And I go, yeah. She goes, well, how do you want to work it? I go, well, be honest, I usually don't rehearse anything. I said, I just, you know what I got in my head, you know, bundle a, you know, whole bag of crazy. And I let it fly. And she goes, let's keep this as dirty as possible. I says, well, you don't have to talk about you. Let's talk about when I was a working girl, because she was a prostitute at one time, too. And did a bunch of other crazy shit. Escorts. She worked at the Dixie, remember the Dixie Hotel on 42nd Street. There's memories. So, yeah, she had done all this stuff. So we got in there and, like, you know, we didn't know. We only sold, like, a couple tickets online. And I said, I don't know what's going to happen here. And it took me, like, 50 minutes to get over there and an hour and a half to find a fucking parking space. So, you know, when I say I'm getting off the East Coast, you know why. But anyway, we went in, introduced myself. You know, they gave me a beer on the house, which my star status demands. But anyway, now I get a beer. So, you know, we're talking. They show me the room. The room's pretty cool. And I'm thinking, how many people can fit in here? And, you know, everybody likes to do really good on their first night out. Especially I wanted to do good for Eric because he's going to keep running these things. So holds about maybe 90 people crammed in. So I don't know how many we had. We really didn't make any money. You know, probably a lot of, you know, people comped in because they're in the business and stuff. But it was, you know, like, nice to meet Veronica Vera, who has been in a few 80s porn films. Actually, she directed one. She wrote a couple. She was in Night Hunger. And she runs, I think, Miss Veronica Vera's school for boys who want to be girls. This cross-dressing thing, which I remember seeing advertised in Screw. So, you know, she's been around a while. I never met her, and she was pretty cool. And some other people who knew of me or knew me or might have ran into me in the past. So it was a cool night. And we got up there, and we rocked and rolled. And she was, you know, we just made it as nasty and crazy as we possibly could. You know, took questions from the crowd. Just a fucking fun time. And then we went out to eat. We were hanging out, talking, and, you know, she's going to probably be coming to Wasteland. And I'm sure if this is a prelude to Wasteland, it's going to be pretty crazy. But, yeah, it was a fucking fun night. Rob from Wild Eye and Lee from the old Pioneer came out, and they were hanging out. Like I said, they go, well, what are you going to do now? You going home? I go, no. Vanessa asked me if I wanted to go out to eat with them guys. And I says, you're going to turn down an invitation to have dinner at a diner with Vanessa Del Rey? So, oh yeah, we went out and I get home a little late, and it was cool.
Yeah, and, you know, it was weird. You know, I was getting phone calls from you at, like, the weirdest times, 1:30 in the morning. I'm like, whoa, Pete's calling me at 1:30 in the morning. This is the weirdest thing ever.
You probably called me when I was on stage. I heard the fucking phone ring, and I'm trying to smother it with my fucking hand. So, it was cool. I'm getting out of here. Right now, the whole thing's up in the air because there's a snag with the fucking house, as usual, with the damn government and all the other shit they pull. You know, there's another thing, too, that pisses me off, to digress off the whole thing. All this fucking messes they make, and you come in to buy government – what's a HUD house? House of Urban Development or something?
Don't get me started on that kind of crap. Yeah
well, anyway, I got the house. I'm supposed to have the house.
Section 8.
Whatever. I'm buying the fucking place outright, all right? There's no mortgage. There's no borrowing. There's no nothing. They want a proof of whatever I sent it to them, and because it didn't – whatever the hell it was, didn't meet their stupid-ass rigid standards or whatever, the fucker went back on the market tomorrow. Yesterday, rather. So my realtor's on the thing. He's pissed off. I said, you know, what the fuck? I gave him, you know, what they wanted.
Tell me
they want a fucking certified check. I'll mail the motherfucker out right now. I'll overnight it to you.
They don't want that. It's the government. They don't want you to give them straight-out cash or checks or money. They want you to pay a bunch of, you know, taxes, and they want you to pay a bunch of commission fees, and they want you to pay all this interest for years and years into the pockets of a bunch of people that really don't need it.
No, they're not getting nothing. I'm buying the fucker, and that's it. You know,
if
it doesn't work out, I'll go back out there and fuck. I said I'm done with this area, dude. This whole, you know, not nothing knocking what happened the other night, because what happened the other night was great, but you know, I can't bank on, you know, something like that building up, and I hope for, you know, Eric's sake that it does build up, and I'll help him all I can. But, you know, I got to start thinking to myself, and I got to get the fuck out of here. And, I got people I want to see. My good friend Beverly from out in California, who I talk to all the time on the phone like real people.
There you go.
She's going to meet me out there. We're going to see what happens, you know, once we meet.
Oh, she's going to come out to Ohio?
Yeah, you know, when I get out there, come out and hang out for a week, and you know,
I don't Chick-fil-A think Californians do well in Ohio. I think it causes them to have some kind of meltdowns. I think there's some kind of, you know.
No, when California is about to be inundated with radioactive Japanese fucking furniture and plastic shit that's going to be sucked up from the tsunami, it's time to get the fuck out and realize that it's done. It's over.
Man, I'll you're going to have a
fucking
left.
Toyota wash up in your backyard that's fucking glowing in the dark. You know, fucking problem. Really?
That's so. I'll be the only one left. Godzilla and I will be hanging out in L.A.
Well, I'm surprised they haven't resurrected that. Here's a perfect opportunity for a comeback. Nuclear meltdown. Godzilla actually shows up.
You just throw a box turtle in and Gamera will come flying across the
sea. Oh, I'm Gamera. You know, I keep selling that fucking movie, Gamera the Brave. I don't know why. What's the fascination with that? Some little kid and the big fucking turtle.
I love all the Gamera movies. I just can't find them around here, which is just frustrating as hell.
Oh, too bad. So that's why you wanted me to move out there. You wanted me to move out there and be a bigger prick than I am. At least, you know, where I'm trying to go, there's a couple, you know, record stores still and head shops and porn stores, you know.
Well, there's tons of that here. You know, this is the biggest seller for your market right here in the Midwest here in old Missouri.
I can understand that there's no horror, but there's porn and religion.
Yeah, every three
two
inches.
Two things that absolutely positively don't go together, porn and religion.
It's like this, porn store, church, porn store, church, porn store, strip club, church. That's what we get.
Crucifixion Highway. Da, 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 da. Well, I don't know. But, you know, going back to that whole thing, it was just a cool night, very cool night, and look forward to doing Wasteland with her and whoever else we get out there. Because we already went over that very drunkenly. Well, not drunk. We were actually pretty sober, but, you know, me and Ken were just burnt, you know? We were just burnt from, you know, hanging out all week and, you know, just from coming off from Wasteland, because Wasteland was great. So it will continue to be great. You know, I was trying to get Mike Lisa from Saturday Nightmares on, because there's a whole bunch of stuff brewing down there, and that's, you know, the 3rd, 4th, and 5th of June. And it's going to be a whole different ball game in the Meadowlands at the Sheraton in East Rutherford. And the guest lineup, you know, is constantly updating. I believe they just added John Amplis from Martin and Day of the Dead. And, of course, you know, Bruce Dern, Karen Black, Julian Sands, Sid Haig, Dawn of the Dead reunion, Return of the Living Dead reunion. They're going to do a reenactment of something from Dawn of the Dead. I think the TV show, the TV spot from Dawn of the Dead, I think they're going to do a reenactment of that. And I know they're going to have a zombie walk. First time ever in Round Giant Stadium, a zombie walk. And Jackalope 105 FM and 42nd Street Pete's Grindhouse have been invited to attend. And we're going to attempt to do a live thing. You know, if we can pull this off. We tried to do it at Wasteland, but thanks to the twittering twats, we couldn't do it. But we're going to try to do this. Todd's going to try to come out. If not, he's going to hook me up with some technical help so I can do this. And it's going to be a cool thing. It may be my last East Coast appearance. Well, actually, you want to be technical. Yeah, my last East Coast appearance will be at the WSU Uncensored Rumble on June 26th. And then I'm not ruling out, you know, coming back for some, you know, bigger events or things like. I'll always come back for the big WSU shows because, you know, they've been a big part of this show, and, you know, it's a very cool thing. As for anything else, if people really want me to come back, it's going to have to be a paycheck involved at this stage of the game. I mean, you know, if Saturday Nightmares wants me, you know, I do good, and, you know, as long as I think I'm okay, and you know, the show works out, they want me back in any capacity, you know, fine, you know. But as for some other people, you know, you want me around, it's going to have to cost. You know, I'm not going to do this shit for nothing anymore. I'm not going to travel. I'm doing this basically so I can survive, because, to be perfectly honest with everybody, if I stay where I am another year, I'm not going to be surviving. I don't know where I'm going to be. So I'm just gambling everything on this whole move. I just want to, you know, end this whole thing, endless cycle of huge bills and shit and all this other crazy stuff, and maybe sit down, maybe actually finish my book, get some other projects going. There's a lot of friends out in that area, in the Pittsburgh area, which is close. So you know, like I'll be lacking for things to do and people to hang out with for a change, as opposed to here where there's, you know, hardly anybody and everybody's married or dead or shit. So that's that. So actually, I had something different I thought of for tonight, remainder of tonight, that is.
What's that?
Origins of the whole Grindhouse film.
Man, that goes all the way back to the Carnies, though, doesn't it? When they were doing
I'm going to go for a specific thing that certain things that basically they were tailor-made for grindhouses and drive-ins. They made no bones about it. And a lot of very, very talented people either came out of that or, you know, were in that on their downward slide where they still had name value on a marquee, even though, you know, the star had faded. And a lot of, you know, what would become your superstars of the 70s and 80s. And one of the first companies to emerge from that, you know, the whole thing was they were doing something that, you know, when the whole drive-in thing popped up, I believe that was in the 50s, early 50s. Now, that was a whole new audience. And teenagers were a whole new market to market to. So where the big pictures, like, you know, the major studios weren't going to market to them, other outfits were. And what happened was it was a company called ARC, American Releasing Corporation. And one of their first double features was Day the World Ended and Phantom from 10,000 Leagues. And Day the World Ended was a Roger Corman film, one of his first. And, you know, this was like I said, I don't know if I said on interviews, I don't know if I ever said it on the radio, that this was one of the big fears growing up was the impending nuclear holocaust. And Day the World Ended was about TD Day, Total Destruction Day, and how seven people survived because they were in this, you know, valley where the hills were loaded with lead, so they didn't get the radiation. And, like, one guy had been exposed to radiation, and part of his face was fucked up and shit. But there was mutants, and, you know, the mutants were killing off all the animals in the valley, and then, you know, probably going after the humans. And there's a whole subplot where some other things are going on. But the amazing thing about it was the mutant, which was affectionately called Marty the Mutant, was created by a guy named Paul Blaisdell, who did some amazing stuff with very little. And on several occasions, he almost lost his life or was severely injured, and he died from some weird diseases, which were probably, you know, I read his book and they never came around and said it, but it was probably some kind of cancer, and probably aided by his exposure to all the chemicals and solvents and, you know, things, prosthetics he was using back at the time, because nobody knew how bad this was to be, you know, exposed to your skin or inhale and shit. But Marty the Mutant was a big three-eyed mutant with a little devilish face and other arms growing out of his shoulders, and he was made by gluing foam over long underwear, I think, if I remember right. And that was all, you know, painted and stuff to become, you know, all scaly and shit. And one scene where it was raining out, he almost drowned because he fell in the water and, like, this you know, the foam rubber just absorbs the shit like a sponge. So it almost drowned him. But, you know, there was your first, one of your first, you know, sci-fi horror double bills released strictly to the grindhouses and the drive-ins by ARC, which actually became American International Pictures with Samuel R. Koff and Jack Nicholson. And that was done on a $3,000 loan that created that whole thing, if I remember correctly. And, you know, Corman was one of, you know, the first people working there. And, you know, probably one of the first guys to, like, recognize talent, give talent a break, as I take a hit of wine. It's hard work packing your shit, not knowing where you're fucking going. But, yeah.
That is true. That is true. You're packing your shit. You think you're going somewhere, and all of a sudden, hey, we don't know where you're going.
Yeah, all of a sudden, you're not. But, you know, the whole thing was, there was such a market for, you know, certain films, especially if you double build them for the, you know, the drive-in and, you know, Grindhouse, you know, I guess they some people call four wall theaters, is a whole different, you know, concept of that. But, you know, he started directing. It looks like, you know, when ARC was, you know, first created, like, in 54, and, you know, the Day the World Ended with the double bill, and he had also done black and white Western called Apache Woman. And he did a few Westerns, Oklahoma Woman, The Gunslinger, and Five Guns West, all between, you know, 54 and 56. And, you know, the day the world ended, then, you know, he, the big monsters were great. Another Blaisdell creation was It Conquered the World. You know, the cucumber creature, they used to call it. And, you know, here we go again with, you know, the star Lee Van Cleef and Beverly Garland. So, you know, there you go with that. And, you know, also in, you know, Swamp Woman, that was Beverly Garland, Jonathan Hayes, I think, Mary Astor. You know, a lot of different things. Naked Paradise, he was doing that, you know, the teen stuff. And, you know, here's another famous double bill, because it wasn't all, you know, he didn't do it all for AIP. He did it for Allied Artists, too. And, you know, there's another famous double bill, which I loved when I was a kid and I still love to this day, was Attack. They just released this shit, too, Attack of the Career Monsters and Not of This Earth. And, you know, there's where Russell Johnson, you know, the professor on Gilligan's Island, you know, he was doing a lot of this stuff back then, you know, playing a heavy in the B-Westerns and things. And, of course, you know, Not of This Earth was Beverly Garland again. And I believe her and Roger were an item at one time, going way back. And, you know, it Not of This Earth was also, you know, had Jonathan Hayes. Dick Miller always showed up in these things. Paul Birch, who was also in Day of the World Ended. And The Crab Monsters was just, you know, just one, you know, cool movie. Now, I don't know if you remember this, because this gets confused with the Australian one. There was a big reincarnation thing going on back in the 50s. You know, these little crazes came, you know, came once a year and then disappeared. You never heard of them again. And I think this there was the story of Bridley Murphy. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah, kind of roughly. Yeah. And you know what? I want to get this in real quick. What people need to realize is these stars and these movies were what was actually keeping Hollywood afloat, because they had those inflated movies that they would have an audience, then the audience would be over. These movies, they would play for 10 years on the circuit. And you'd see the same movie several times coming through town, and you'd always go see it again, because this was before the VCR thing was going. And they really carried the Hollywood system.
Yeah. So, you know, getting back to this whole thing, Corman wanted, you know, a Bridley Murphy deal, and he comes up to this thing, The Undead, which they filmed, I believe it was in a converted supermarket, was a soundstage. And this is one of my favorite things. I'll do this Halloween night the minute all the parties are over and shit, as I'll pop this in, because I just think it's one cool fucking movie with Richard Garland, Pamela Duncan, Richard Devon, Dick Miller shows up in it, Billy Barty, Bruno Visotta, Allison Hayes was fucking great. She was fucking wonderful. She's the one who walked up to Corman and said, "Roger, who do I gotta fuck to get off this picture?" That was her famous line. It was serious. He did so much of this double bill stuff, and they flip it. Like, and he gave so many guys like a start. Like, here's one. Before Bronson was Death Wish and all that other thing, Corman saw something in him, and he played the role, the lead in Machine Gun Kelly, which I just bought on 16mm. It's wow. Not out here. I think Shout Factory does have the rights to it. We figured that out, so, you know, I wouldn't put it out and get fucked over by a copyright deal. But,
well, I'm ready for him to release some of that stuff.
If anybody from Shout Factory is listening and you need a print, I have a print. You know,
you ought to send him an email.
What?
You ought to send him an email.
I know. I should. You got the right email address?
I could send it to you.
All right, do that. Maybe I can. I'll cut a deal. I'll loan them the fucking print. You know, rent. I'll tell you what. Just give me product.
That's true.
That's all. That's I'm not true. Fucking greedy. Loan. I'll tell you what. I'm not going to make my deal on the air. Fuck that.
We'll make our deal off the air.
Off the air. Yeah. But yeah, and Machine Gun Kelly had a great cast too. You know, Susan Cabot, Jack Lambert, Wally Campo, Richard Devon again, Frank DeCova. Oh, shit. Maury Amsterdam. I mean, just a great fucking cast. It's just, you know, such great stuff. And, you know, like I said, they weren't the only ones doing it, too, because, you know, smaller studios like Astor Pictures and things like that, they were doing, like, And I know all this stuff's public domain, like Giant from the Unknown and Frankenstein's Daughter. Attack of the Giant Leeches was Film Group, I think. What was the other great one? Beast from Haunted Cave. Another couple other Corman ones. Bucket of Blood, The Wasp Woman. The thing with he did Skeet Troop Attack. And that was co-billed with Beast from Haunted Cave because they were both shot out near Deadwood in North Dakota, I think. Isn't Deadwood in North Dakota?
Gosh.
You still there?
Yeah, I know. I'm here. Deadwood, North Dakota. I'm thinking about it. Yeah, I think that's it. Yeah, I think that's it.
Yeah, that I believe that, you know, as Frank Wolf was in both of those, and he went out to, he did a lot of spaghetti westerns in Europe before he committed suicide. So
probably because he lived in Deadwood.
There's so much of this stuff. It was just tailor made for that, and it sort of drifted in like when you went into the '60s with the Poe pictures, like, you know, the Pit and the Pendulum was the one they didn't think was going to work. House of Usher, that they couldn't convince the powers that be at AIP that, you know, the house was the monster because they were always used to having the monsters and stuff.
Right,
but. You know, and there was just so much of that stuff going on that where they double bill, like The Blob and Dinosaurus. I saw in a double bill at Grindhouse when I was a kid. Other ones that they came up with, you know, going through the '60s, when, you know, the Del Tenney double feature, Horror Party Beach and Curse of the Living Corpse, and, you know, Roy Scheider, one of his first, I think that was his first film, and Candace Hilligoss, who was also in Carnival of Souls, she was in that.
Yeah, but, you know, Pete, during that era, actors wanted to work, and these people were believing in their product. It was a smaller budgeted product, but they still, you know, they were having a good time. They were filling the marketplace with what the marketplace wanted, and we still want it today. The difference today is these guys that are in charge of studios today are guys that used to be managers at Applebee's, and they think they know better than we do what we need to watch. But back then, you know, kids that, hey, you released I Was a Teenage Werewolf and I Was a Teenage Frankenstein. Well, we need more movies like that. They went out and made more movies like that, and they got decent actors to do it. And the thing was, nowadays, it's kind of gotten to the point where a lot of people, you know, in the lower budgeted movies, they don't know their craft at all. I mean, not even a little, you know, whereas back then, these guys were real actors.
Well, it was like, wasn't they really went out to get, you know, they got guys who were, you know, were trying to be up and coming, and, you know, out of those ranks, you know, like I said, you know, prime example, Lee Van Cleef, who really didn't, you know, hit it big until years later. Also with Bronson, even though he did get the lead in that, you know, Machine Gun Kelly, and that's considered one of Corman's most respected films. You know, he really didn't, you know, he didn't hit it big until Death Wish. I mean, everybody knew who he was, but, you know, it was always like, okay, you know, and starring so-and-so, then da-da-da, and Charles Bronson, you know, so he was always on the under. Where, you know, like I said, that took him to kick off. But, you know, another one was John Ashley and all those beach party movies and stuff. You know, look what he accomplished, you know, going over to the Philippines and, you know, working that whole deal with Hemisphere and then New World and, you know, the Corman connection and just really investing his money smart, you know, owning all this property out in the Midwest and shit and still making movies up until the day he died. And unfortunately, he died really young. And, you know, just other guys that just came out of that whole thing, you know, that independent Jack Hill thing that nobody knew what the fuck it was. Spider Baby, which was released, you know, is the Liver Eaters, Cannibal Orgy, the maddest story ever told. And, you know, Sid Haig came out of that whole thing.
Yep, great movie.
Yeah. So, you know, all this stuff basically, it's either spawned your next generation, you know, your next couple, you know, 20 or 30 years of character actors and great directors and great producers and great writers. You know, like Charles Griffin, you know, with Little Shop of Horrors and all the other stuff. You know, some people don't know that Leo Gordon was a screenwriter. I believe he actually wrote Attack of the Giant Leeches. So, you know, here you had this great mix of these people all just, you know, doing stuff always. You know, and I don't know if there was any infighting or not. We don't know about that. But, you know, just the whole body of work speaks for itself. And, you know, like I said, this shit was tailored to, you know, people like me growing up. And it's like, you know, they make the Dirty Dozen, fine. That was in 63. So the next year, Corman makes the Secret Invasion with half a Dirty Dozen. You know, the knockoffs and spin-ups. So they were a lot of fun, too. And, you know, here's another great one he did. St. Valentine's Day Massacre. I think Warner Brothers released that. I'm not sure. But that, you know, here's another, what a fucking cast in that. Jason Robards. It just reads like a who's who. It, just everybody. Dick Miller, Leo Gordon, Bruce Dern, George Segal, Ralph Meeker. I'm just the ones off the top of my head. John Agar. Fuck, who the hell else?
Well, Corman had an idea. He knew that, honestly, that these people were honestly on their way up, or they were, you know, steady actors that he had admired. And he, you know, he put them in the pictures. He saw something in a lot of people. I mean, let's be honest. He knew how to pick talent. That was one of his great abilities. Oh, yeah. And look what he did with William Shatner. I mean, that movie Intruder is still powerful to this day.
Oh, yeah. That's another one. That's the one of the few he actually lost money on.
Well, yeah, you know, and the funny thing is, he shot it here in Missouri,
yeah.
And they chased him out of Dodge when they found out that he had a pro-freedom message. They chased his butt out of here. Yeah. It was a pretty neat story.
Another one was, you know, Bloody Mama with, you know, De Niro, Don Stroud. I don't know if was Dern in that too. I think Dern was in that too.
I think so. That was a great movie. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was just watching the Big Bad Mama double feature recently, and that was a lot of fun.
Yeah. And, you know, according to, you know, what I've been reading, he's uncredited in a few things like Battle Beyond the Stars. I thought that was John Sayles.
Huh, yeah. John Sayles directed that, right?
Never know. But I remember the other one, he was early 50s. Like I said, when he got into 54, he produced that Monster from the Ocean Floor. And I'm pretty much sure that was an ARC thing.
Man, I'm not trying to change the subject because I really love the subject. But while I'm thinking about it, we talked about Shout Factory, and it's popping in my head three times before I forget. Have you know that movie Sorceress came out? And I love that movie. It's never been released on DVD. It was out on that horrible EMI video transfer, all murky and yellow.
Yeah.
And I really want – I saw that sucker at the theater like three times, you know, and I'm like, I really want that thing on DVD or something. I really do. So if you think Shout Factory might have that one?
From what I understand, you know, Rob, we were going down a thing. I just had the off chance that fucking Machine Gun Kelly was not copywritten, and it was an 86, and the source was a 3/4-inch master. And I'm like, okay, that I can do this. So we just hit Shout Factory, and they got 30 of the AIP titles.
Wow.
Yeah. And they got stuff like nobody's put out. Like, you know, they had a couple of war movies. Hell Squad, War is Hell.
Wow.
Suicide Battalion. And a lot of guys were in that, too.
That's true.
And I remember watching this shit late. You know, I didn't catch it in the movies because they didn't. I don't think they re-released that, you know, for the kiddie matinees because it wasn't too cool.
But, the war stuff, yeah.
Yeah, but it was on late at night, and I used to watch it, and it was pretty always. Good stuff.
And then
like, John Ashley was in it. And
yeah, exactly.
Richard Devon.
And there'd be like episodes of the Rat Patrol stuck around there somewhere. Yeah, I remember those late nights on TV.
No, the Rat Patrol was after this. They were using, you know, the World War II stock footage.
Ah, gotcha.
Yeah, so it was pretty cool shit. But, you know, they never what's funny, too? Even when this was a kid, this had to be in the 60s. Hammer had them fucking Blood Island movies, the Japanese POW camps where Michael Ripper had his eyes taped back like a Japanese guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't see them fucking things around. They were pretty nasty.
Well, yeah. Yeah, they were shocking for the time. Well, they'd probably be shocking today even. Yeah.
Yeah, they put the pirate stuff out, though, and those were pretty fucking good.
Yep, yep.
It was another grindhouse staple, the sword and sorcerer shit and the pirate shit. Sword and sandal and the pirate shit, the Hercules stuff and all that.
Oh, yeah. And that kind of morphed through the years. I mean, through the 70s, it kind of waned a little. And then all of a sudden, you started getting, because the sword and sandal stuff kind of got kind of pushed aside by the martial arts stuff for a while. Then it came back around because right there at the end of the 70s, we started getting all those like Excalibur type movies again. You know, all the Iron Warrior stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, because I remember seeing shit like we get the Goliath thing, like Goliath and the Vampires,
yep.
And Goliath and the Dragon, and Goliath and the Barbarians, and what the hell was that other one?
I remember all those.
Oh, fuck, I'm trying to think of this one. It was pretty, damn.
I remember like Machiste in Hell or something like that.
Yeah, Machiste in Hell.
Yeah.
There was another one.
Those were all around, and the Hercules movies with Steve Reeves.
Yeah, the Steve Reeves stuff was good. Yeah, that was cool. And then it was Reg Parks became Hercules. Hercules in a Haunted World, that was a Bava one.
Yeah.
That was cool. That shit was great in the grindhouses because some of the people, you know, the best one was Broderick Crawford in Goliath and the Dragon, you know, as you know, the Emperor Broderick Crawford. I'm losing my shit with that, you know.
I'm sure.
That's good stuff. And
those movies like were entertaining as hell. The one thing they knew about it was don't bore the audience. They've got to have a fight scene every 3.2 minutes. You know, you got to do this and this and this.
Yeah, the Russian one, Sword and the Dragon.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that was you know what else was fucking cool too and really nasty? Genghis Khan.
I never got to see that one originally.
Oh, I don't even know if that's out, but that was Omar Sharif and Stephen Boyd, Neil Irwin. That was pretty fucking brutal. Caught that one. That was, you know, that was like, holy fuck, for a kiddie matinee, you're sticking this in. This is great shit, you know? This is great.
Well, yeah, it was weird because the kiddie matinees would sometimes have the weirdest, they would have Hammer horror films because they were rated either GP. And then
there was no rating back then,
right.
Though.
Remember when they did, though, when they had right around Curse of Frankenstein, they started bringing in the GP and the PGs, but the PG didn't happen until later.
No, they did. That didn't happen until that. I don't think that shit started going on until like, I'm going to say like 60, maybe 68 it started.
Right. But isn't that when Curse of Frankenstein came out? I thought that came out in 68.
No, Curse of Frankenstein was 57.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Damn, I'm way off.
Yeah. Yeah, shit, because I remember...
I just remember some of those Dracula movies playing here at the drive-in with a GP.
Oh, here's one for you wouldn't think. They had Tarzan films at the Grindhouse. They're not released. I think Paramount put them out, and I think it was Gordon Scott.
Yeah, yeah.
And one of them, I remember one of them distinctly had Sean Connery and John Carradine. It was like a renegade family and shit. And John Carradine was the father. Sean Connery was one of the sons, and a couple other people. Then I remember another one where Anthony Quayle was the bad guy and shit. It was Tarzan. I can't fucking remember. I looked it up on the IMDb because nobody has this shit.
True, true.
And some of this was pretty wild shit too.
Yeah, I liked a lot of those Tarzan movies. You know, they weren't Weissmuller, but they were still pretty kick ass. I thought, you know.
Yeah, well, like I said, when they had Gordon Scott doing it, he was pretty credible because he was all muscled out and shit, you know.
We had Tarzan Theater here on Sundays.
Tarzan with the ducktail in Africa.
I know it.
50s DA, yeah, it was probably, but it was good shit, you know. Especially when you had people like Carradine and, you know, Connery and some of the other heavies involved. That was good shit.
Yeah, I agree. That was good stuff.
That's the Grindhouse Fair. See, that's how far back it goes. People just think, you know, and a lot of people just think the whole thing tapped in with the 70s when Night of the Living Dead kicked open the door with the blood and guts and shit. But the reality of it was going on. It started with when they started doing the open air drive-ins, and they weren't just going to regulate the films to that. They'd run them in the inner cities because they needed cheaper programming. And those were the double bills, and like, fuck it, they were all over the place. Horror Party Beach, Curse of the Living Corpse. Yeah, it was great shit. You know, then I Drink Your Blood, I Eat Your Skin in like 70, whatever it was.
You know, the Horror of Party Beach, I actually held that outfit in my hand because it was on display at the Inglewood Theater here in Independence, Missouri, where I was working. And Wade Williams owns it. So he has that monster. He's a jerk, but the monster was cool.
How did he get that goddamn thing?
Man, that guy, you know, even though he's a jerk, he had some pretty good taste in movies. He loved all that sci-fi stuff, the early horror stuff. He loved it. But, yeah, I mean, no counting for being a jerk.
Yeah, because that even though that was a beach party movie, that was shot in Connecticut.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's where Del Tenney shot in Connecticut.
That's
so
right.
It was Curse of the Living Corpse. And he did something else, too. I can't remember. The only two I really ever saw were those two. I don't remember, the other ones. But you know, when you go back to the other stuff, even the AIP non-Corman stuff, like Terror from the Year 5000 and Panic in the Year Zero. That's another great one with Ray Milland and Frankie Avalon and, a bunch of heavies that you would know.
I'm getting ready to watch Earth vs. Flying Saucers, the Harryhausen.
Oh yeah, that's another thing too. Those were all kicked out there because
the Sinbad flicks.
The majors were not above trying to copycat the minors to get people in. And they had just for example, the Thing, the original Thing. You know, that probably wouldn't, it would have wound up in a grindhouse. But the stuff was basically, when they were doing stuff like Gorgo and Beast from 20,000 Fathoms oh, Giant Behemoth and
20,000 Miles to Earth, or what was that? 20 Million Miles to Earth?
25 Million Miles to Earth and stuff. I mean, you know, basically they were just bigger budgeted grindhouse stuff. I mean, you know, if one of the grindhouse guys was making a dinosaur movie, they were using fucking lizards with fins glued to them. Even the Lost World remake, with all the money they had in there, it still had the same fucking iguana with fins glued to it. So, you know, the more life imitates art, but that's, you know, your minor guys back in the 50s, if they were going to do something with, you know, involved a dinosaur, they fucking threw an iguana in there.
Yeah, I know.
Not that they were nice about it either. They probably killed the fucker, but
I hope not. Yeah, hope not. But yeah, they used to do some pretty bad stuff.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's what they did. But that's the whole precursor to what's happening today. And the funny part is, and I even wrote this at one time. There was a movie, and I caught it when I was a kid, and I didn't even know it was in color because, you know, this was back in, God, I was born in 52, so, you know, we're probably watching this stuff when I was like 10, 11, so figure in the 60s. And Unknown Island was on with Barton MacLean and Richard Denning and Virginia Gray, you know, a few other people you'd know. And it was basically, you know, on this island full of dinosaurs, you know, the men in the suit ones and shit. And they had this, you know, this sloth creature, which was the scariest fucking thing. It looked like a part gorilla, part whatever, with fangs and shit. I never knew it was in color until I bought the DVD. But my point is now, here's a real oldie film that probably would have been stuck, you know, in the grindhouses, because the grindhouses were basically, you know, picked up by the brand organizations in New York in the 40s on 42nd Street. So, you know, odds are this would have popped in there. That's the type of thing, you know, exploitation or escapism you'd want. But you segue back into Jurassic Park 3 and you watch those two films back to back, they're almost an identical film. As far as plot-wise, you know, this, you know, Unknown Island had this fucking gorilla-like boogeyman, and Jurassic Park 3 had that Spikeosaurus thing.
Yeah.
That's the only Jurassic Park I really like, because I think Joe Johnson was a big fan of this stuff, because it had several things that were, you know, obviously homages are lifted from, you know, 50s film. Like, you know, when the guy took the egg, remember they took baby Gorgo back to London?
Yeah.
You know, and then Mama Gorgo shows up and flattens Big Ben.
Exactly. So,
another great grindhouse film.
Yep, I like that one. I like Conga. I like both of those.
Oh, Conga. There's another one. Conga and Horrors from the Black Museum. British.
Yep.
You know, British grindhouse stuff. And they were cool and nasty, too.
Well, and Pete, I think those were still so popular because even in like the late 60s, early 70s, they were doing things like the Twilight people, the Bat people. We still had things like the Gargoyles movie, you know, that played a lot of places in theaters.
A wild one, the Gargoyles, yeah. There's another one. You ever see The Naked Prey?
Yeah.
That's a grindhouse film.
Oh, yeah.
That was pretty nasty. That was almost like they could have double billed that with the cut version of Africa Blood and Guts.
There you go.
Somebody probably did, because, you know, it's funny. I wish I could go back into the papers and pull some of the really weird pairings that I've seen at grindhouses, you know, back in the 70s. Really, like I saw Hell's Angels 69 and Spirits of the Dead. That was a double bill.
There was a lot of good double bills, because you know what? People knew how to, like, right now, we have a drive-in down the road playing Insidious, which is a kind of decent horror flick, but they're playing it with a kids movie, a cartoon. Mm. I'm going, what in the hell? People don't know how to do double bills anymore. They've completely lost their minds.
No, well, see, that was another thing that sort of sunk in when these assholes threw Night of the Living Dead out as a kiddie matinee. Remember that whole deal?
Yeah.
Complete fucking stupidity. But I always said, you know, when I was a kid, I said, God bless the irresponsible bastards who booked the kiddie matinees, because that's where I got my horror education. I mean, I got in early, and, like, they were still doing... I got to see Creature from the Black Lagoon and Return... was it Revenge of the Creature?
Oh, yeah. Those were kiddie matinees, yeah.
Yeah, great, on a fucking panoramic screen. If I could have came, then I would have. You know?
Those were amazing.
Oh, you know, great shit, you know, then... Every once in a while, you know, they throw out like a real art thing, like House of Frankenstein, House of Dracula.
Oh, yeah, I love those. Yep. I remember those. And Abbott and Costello stuff they'd put out, too.
Oh, yeah, that was great.
So, hey, you know what? You just said something. You were talking earlier about all the great actors, actresses, directors that came out of this era. Well, hell, right there, Revenge of the Creature. Let's talk about Clint Eastwood.
Oh, yeah.
You know, right there.
Exactly. And Tarantula, he was the fighter pilot.
Yep. That's where he came from. And look at him now. You know, he's like one of the renowned directors and actors of our time.
You know, he was fired by Universal. They thought he had no potential. Him and Burt Reynolds the same day.
Jerks.
I knock Burt, but Burt's another 70s icon, you know?
I agree.
You had four of them. You had Eastwood, Van Cleef, Bronson, and Reynolds.
You did. Yeah, that was kind of the 70s. That was the main 70s mainstays. And then Robert Forster was coming along toward the end of the 70s there, going into the 80s. Yeah. Robert was doing some good stuff.
Very underrated guy and a very nice guy, too.
Exactly. I just watched Vigilante on Blu-ray. I found it, and I got to watch it about 3 or 4 days ago. It was great.
Yeah. You know, like I said, you don't find actors like that. And like I said, you know, the talent that just AIP and Corman in general spawned. I mean, it just boggles the mind. That was like your next 30 years worth of character actors and, you know, mainstream actors and, like, you know, brilliant directors and brilliant writers and stuff. And, you know, it's sad because what do you really got today? You got a bunch of fucking hacks.
You made me just now sit here and think about some of the cool villains from back then, too. And I always pictured John Saxon, you know, from the 70s doing cool stuff in some of those movies. You know, he was...
Bruce Dern used to play a fucking lunatic and all that
stuff.
He was
great.
You know?
Dennis Hopper.
I mean, Hell's Angels. I mean, you know, the Wild Angels movie. The whole deal. You know, incredible two-headed transplant.
I love that stuff,
These guys cut... Even Dennis Hopper. Dennis Hopper did a ton of crappy biker
movies. I love it. I love Dennis Hopper. Yeah, he did crazy stuff.
Yeah. But that's the whole thing. It's like, you know... You don't have that anymore. You had that whole, you know, this stuff was just tailor-made for that. And, like, I you know, Dave Young called me last night that he found a theater to try and sell or something. And I says, well, you know, I wish you all the best. I, you know, maybe you can do something. Maybe you can. I don't know.
Well, and that's the thing. You know, a lot of people are today love this stuff as much as us. And bless them, they're trying. They're putting out these movies that are kind of homages to the Grindhouse era. But like you've said numerous times, we'll never be there again. And the reason is, like, even though I may like some of these movies, and I like, you know, them doing the scratchy film where sometimes they actually shoot on film to scratch the hell out of it before they make a print. And that's cool. Sometimes they use a digital process. Either way, I understand what they're trying to do and I respect it. But... It all comes down to some of those, no matter how hard they're trying, they're filled with blood, they're filled with boobs, they're filled with the three Bs, they got monsters, but they're still so slow in parts, and they still don't just get it. There was like a fun, exciting life to those films you're talking about. They had real actors, like we're mentioning. They had people who at least were honing their craft, even if they were just up-and-comers. You had people like Jack Nicholson who were serious about doing something. You had scriptwriters who were actually Oscar-caliber scriptwriters who were writing these movies because they loved monster movies, and that's how they were making a paycheck on the side. You had people who genuinely wanted to have a good time. These were like going to the carnival. These were like going to the amusement park for kids and for, you know, young kids. I'm not talking about like little kids. I'm talking about, you know, teenagers. I'm talking about people like us who grew up with this stuff. This is what we loved. And you could tell it because the filmmakers didn't look down on it. Roger Corman looked at these movies like they were Oscar caliber material to him. They didn't look down on it. And that's the thing, you know, a lot of times today, even though people are trying really hard, and, you know, like I was watching Shadow Dead Riot. And I like Shadow Dead Riot for what it is. But there's something missing, and it just doesn't have the punch. It doesn't have the fun factor, and it doesn't have the energy it needs. It's kind of dull.
It ain't even that. Just like I said, these guys are pioneers, whether they thought they were doing Oscar caliber shit or not. You know, to them, a buck was a buck, and this was a way to make money. I mean, you look at the Flesh Eaters. I mean, that one scene, that grisly scene when that thing is like burrowing through his leg, you know damn well they took a hot fucking something and Nick burned the film printer negative to get that effect there. That's what it looks like.
Yeah. Yes.
No, I mean, Flesh Eaters.
Yeah.
You know, all that stuff. It's just, you know, it's just a shame that there's nothing, you know, to me, there's nothing to look forward to with this stuff. I hope they find, you know, prints of stuff that I had seen once and never seen again. Like, I dug up that Young Fury thing, which is the original Young Guns.
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah.
It was fucking crazy, and nobody's put this out. I mean, I bought a TV print for a ridiculous, you know, $14 or something, but... I've only seen that film once in my entire life at a grindhouse, and it stuck in my mind because it was so, you know, just incredibly violent for that era, you know? But you don't see that, you know? And there's so much of that stuff, that isn't out. I mean, I picked up Javaro too with Fernando Llamas, and I, you know, realized how lame it was, and I just bought it because Lon Chaney Jr. and Brian Keith were in it.
That's it.
Richard Denning, but you know, other than that, it's like, what the fuck was I thinking? But that was another one. It was a $1 million movie. So
I loved Lon Chaney Jr. You know, I'm kind of the same way. Anything Lon Chaney Jr. did, I would get it, and I'll never forget my disappointment when I was so excited with the poster for Dracula versus Frankenstein. You know, I went crazy.
He wasn't on it.
Yeah. It was bad. The movie was bad anyway, but that even made it worse.
Which poster did you get? The one with the fucking black and white one where they're just standing there, or the one where they're actually fighting?
The one they're fighting.
Yeah, the one they're fighting. That just, you know, that just built up everybody's expectations to get let down.
I know, for nothing at all, right? I was so excited as a kid. I got there and it was like Afro Sheen Dracula. What the hell?
Yeah, well.
Now, that's okay for Blackula, but I was kind of wondering about this guy.
Even Gary, when you had Gary Kent on the show, he said, you know, they basically didn't have, they shot all that other shit with him out here. Near Sam's place, I guess, Sherman's place.
Yeah.
I heard that, didn't we talk about this, the whole Daniel Roebuck thing?
Yeah, a little bit. Mm-hmm.
There's no reason to rehash that then. Go download that. Download the fuck up.
We only got 2 minutes left anyway, so you're going to have to download it.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I don't want to get into that anyhow, because I don't know what we're going to do next week, but a lot of people have Rick Cataldo from WSU, Todd's, you know, admirer.
No. Don't blame that on me. Don't even put me in that.
He has requested airtime because he wasn't on the last time, and I said I will get back to him.
Well, he's the one that jumped out of the deal. Come on, Rick. What are you doing? Now you got a request.
I talked to Vanessa tentatively about doing a live call-in show one Saturday.
Oh, so that'd be sweet.
That would be really fucked up. And I got to get Eric Danville on to push the complete Linda Lovelace. We're going to have people on, you know. And like I said, I really hope I can make this move because things will be a lot cooler. We can get some shit done. But and even if we, you know, during the move, you have to bear with me because we may be either doing it off cell phone or throwing in some repeat stuff. But what the fuck. But we are keeping it going. As of my Facebook blog, I'm just, you know, like I said, I just got to worry about Pete for a change, so I got to get settled, got to know where I'm at, you know, with a roof over my head, and that's that, so.
Well, I've been working on a couple of best of compilations for you anyway that are really cool, so we've got plenty to fall back on if we need to. Pete will still be here, and it'll be almost like a brand new show, because it'll be something different each week, one way or the other.
Oh, yes. So, until next week, stay sick, and we'll see you then.
Second Street Pete's Grindhouse is a production of Jackalope 105 FM.
Do you feel that? Oh, shit. Why? Get up, come on, get down with the sickness. Get up, come on, get down with the sickness. Get up. Come on, get down with the sickness. Open up your hate and let it flow into me. Get up, come on, get down with the sickness. You mother, get up, come on, get down with the sickness. You fucker, get up, come on, get down with the sickness. Madness is the gift that has been given to me. I can see inside you the sickness is rising. It seems that all that was good has died. Oh no, the world is a scary place. Now that you've woken up the demon in me.
Bobby, will you give it to me?
2, 3, 4.
Oh,
get up, come on, get down with the sickness. You mother, get up, come on, get down with the sickness. You fucker, get up. Come on, get down with the sickness. Open up your hate and let it flow into me. Why can't you just fuck up and die? Get down with the sickness. Fuck you, I don't need this shit. I'm down with the sickness. You stupid, sadistic, abusive fucking organ. Down with the sickness. Here it comes. Get ready to die. Get ready to
die.
Come on,
Here we go again, motherfucker. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Come on down and see the idiot right here. Too fucked to beg and not afraid to care. What's the matter with calamity anyway? Right, get the fuck out of my face. Understand I can't feel anything. It isn't like I wanna sift through the decay. I feel like a wound, like I got a fucking gun against my head. You live when I'm dead. People equal shit. People equal shit. People equal shit. People equal shit. Come on. Now, so fuck it. Blood on my face and my hands, I don't know why. I'm not afraid to cry, but that is none of your business. Overdo it, don't tell me you blew it. Stop your bitching and fight your way through it. I'm not like you, I just fuck up. Come on, motherfucker, everybody has to die. People equal shit. People equal shit. People equal shit. People equal shit.
What you gotta do?
People equal shit.
I'm not afraid of you.
People equal shit.
Everything you'll ever be.
People equal shit.